Today is Friday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. World leaders are gathering in Canada for the G7 summit, but will they be able to resolve their differences over trade?
In terms of substantive progress, I think the answer, in my opinion, is no.
Plus, we take a look ahead at the U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore and the power of a question. It's all ahead today on International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says he hopes to resolve what he considers unfair trade agreements with U.S. allies at the Group of Seven or G7 summit in Quebec, Canada. He tweeted, "Looking forward to straightening out our unfair trade deals with the G7 countries. If it doesn't happen, we come out even better." The U.S. closest allies are prepared to confront Trump over the steel and aluminum tariffs he imposed on Canada, the European Union, and Mexico. I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman on the phone, and I asked him, prior to leaving to the summit, Mr. Trump made a statement that he thought Russia should be readmitted to the group. I asked him, what was the reaction from attendees?
Well, except for the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, who's only been in office for a week, that's not going over very well. The Canadians, the French, and the British are all saying that they are opposed to this idea. And it's even being brushed off at the Kremlin, where a spokesman is being quoted as saying that Russia is focused on other formats apart from the G7.
Some have gone so far as to say that this is really the G6 plus one, alluding to the tense back and forth, sometimes over social media, regarding trade and other differences. Is that manifesting itself there at the summit?
Yes, all indications are that probably we're not going to get one of these unified communiques at the end of the summit where there is very diplomatic language and they've all agreed to be on the same page. The French President Emmanuel Macron is actually talking about a G6 statement, and also we have Donald Tusk, who's the chairman of the European Union leaders, saying that he's quite surprised that the United States is the one who is challenging the rules-based international order here. So we're talking about what may be a very unprecedented, contentious G7 with President Trump and the United States ending up being quite isolated.
Speaking to that point, the president is leaving on Saturday to travel to Singapore for the summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Is that going to give him enough time to, what he says, resolve all these trade differences?
Probably not. He's leaving a few hours earlier that had been planned. That's not unusual. I think it's not unprecedented for a U.S. president not to be at a G7 from the very beginning to the very end. But the announcement coming after the tweets that President Trump made and then a joint news conference yesterday in Ottawa by Macron and the Canadian host, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, where they were fairly blunt in their criticism of Trump and his trade policies, is making it clear that the president wants to spend as little time as possible here.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. He's in Quebec. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Steve.
Given what has transpired before the summit began, it has become clear that this would be one of the more contentious G7 meetings in memory. I caught up with Jacob Kierkegaard, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics at home, for a little historical context.
We've never seen in the history of the G7 a country that, if you like, abandoned many of the traditional basic tenets of the G7 alliance, if you like. I mean, these are all, after all, countries that have the treaty alliances with the United States, that the basic tenets of that, which includes free and open trade. And you know, I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, the United States is not just any ordinary G7 member. I mean, the United States has, until arguably Donald Trump became president, been the de facto leader of the G7.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. So if until now the United States has been the de facto leader of the G7, who is stepping up to fill that role now?
I mean, I think the reality is that there is no one nation that can do so. No one has the combination of military, political, economic power that the United States has among the other G7 nations. In the combination of all of them has an economic power that clearly is on par with that of the United States. So the reality is that once the United States vacates its leadership role, more than anything else, it's a vacuum that is created. Other countries, we can think of President Macron of France, who tries to grab some of the leadership role from the United States on issues such as climate change and perhaps even international trade. But it doesn't change the fact that first and foremost, it is a vacuum that is left behind by the United States. So in a sense, you could say, yes, there is a G6 plus one, but on a global scale, I think the reality is we're talking about a G0.
So if there is, as you put it, a G0, can we really expect anything from this meeting in Quebec?
No. In terms of substantive progress, I think the answer, in my opinion, is no. And I think the best we can hope for, to a certain extent, is do no harm.
Kierkegaard said that if a joint communique with only 6 signatures is released, meaning without the United States, he says that would highlight perhaps the deepest political split ever within the G7. Here are some more headlines from around the globe. A global cyber threat intelligence company says North Korea's senior leadership has been exploiting loopholes in international sanctions to obtain the U.S. technology that Pyongyang uses to conduct destructive cyber operations. A new report by Save the Children says more than half of the world's children are at risk of poverty, conflict, and discrimination against girls. Warplanes attacked a rebel-held northwestern village in Syria, killing at least 35 people and wounding dozens more, including children, in one of the deadliest incidents in this part of the country this year. For expanded coverage of these stories and more, be sure to visit voanews.com or download our mobile app to take the stories with you. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you visualize a DNA structure, it's probably the well-known double helix that was revealed in 1953 by James Watson and Francis Crick. Australian scientists now say that they have been able to observe and identify a totally new DNA structure inside of a living cell. It's called iMotif. Rather than an elegant-looking double helix, the researchers say the new structure looks more like a twisted knot of DNA. The new iMotif structure has actually been seen and studied before, but under artificial laboratory conditions, not in an actual living cell. In the years since the classic double helix DNA structure was first shown, scientists have determined that short bursts of DNA can be found in other shapes as well. It's thought that the different shaped DNA might help determine just how and when the genetic code is read. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Next week, U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Singapore's Sentosa Island. Speaking aside Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Thursday, the president noted the potential of the meeting.
I hope the upcoming meeting in Singapore represents the beginning of a bright new future for North Korea, and indeed a bright new future for the world. The denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula would usher in a new era of prosperity, security, and peace for all Koreans, North and South, and for people everywhere.
Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has also been paying close attention to the Trump-Kim summit and isn't as optimistic.
We have been down this path before. North Korea is in defiance of numerous United Nations Security Council resolutions in relation to its illegal ballistic missile and nuclear programs. And in the past, North Korea has agreed to do certain things, but then broken those promises.
Earlier today, I spoke with Harry Kazianis via Skype. He's the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. I started our conversation by asking him that when the president said that the Singapore summit was about attitude, if that was somehow lowering expectations for the meeting.
I think some expectations have been lowered, but I really hope the president makes this summit about denuclearization. Really, what the president should be doing is very simple. Really, from now until he actually goes to Singapore, I'm hoping his team is negotiating with the North Koreans on some sort of joint statement that lays out the terms of how North Korea would denuclearize. Because you can't have all the things that have been talked about in the last few days, things like peace treaties, the normalization of diplomatic relations, the removal of sanctions, if you can't get some sort of deal on denuclearization.
Now, do you think that if it's just a high-level joint statement, that would be a non-successful summit? Or just coming to agreement that this is what we're going to work towards to would be good enough?
I think if all we get is an aspirational North Korean declaration of denuclearization, I think it's actually a complete failure. And the reason I say that is because what the United States is giving away is that handshake with Kim Jong-un. That handshake, that photograph will be spilled all over newspapers, social media from now until the end of time. And that is one of the biggest pieces of leverage that we have over North Korea. That would be a legitimizing moment for Kim Jong-un and really the completion of his makeover project that he started since the new year. So if I was Trump, I wouldn't have any photo ops. I would get to Singapore on Air Force One. I'd get off the plane. I'd walk right into the meeting. I wouldn't have any photo ops. I'd look Kim Jong-un in the eye and say, look, do you want to denuclearize or not? Yes or no? If it's anything other than yes, I would walk out and deny him that photo, because that photo is what the North Koreans want. Once that photo is taken, maximum pressure is dead.
You've talking about one of the biggest political risks for the president is not to do Iran deal 2.0, which is he called flawed. It's a disaster. North Korea historically has made deals in the past. Even Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop today said that they've broken consistently every single deal that they have made. So if a great deal, as the president likes to say, is made in Singapore, what real guarantees does the United States have that North Korea would continue upholding its end of the bargain?
Zero. So what we have to do then is the deal would have to be structured in such a way where, I think, first of all, we know the North Koreans aren't just going to give up their nukes. They're not going to just take all their maybe as many as 60 nuclear weapons, put them on the tarmac and have C-130s go pick them up. It's just not going to happen. The deal that could be made is that it would be sort of a phased in or step-by-step approach where the North Koreans give up maybe one to two nukes. We take off some sanctions. North Koreans maybe give up an ICBM or two or a couple missiles. We take off some more sanctions. We go step by step by step. That deal is worth doing because if the North Koreans cheat, you have transparency. You can show the whole world that they've cheated that deal, and we can just go back to maximum pressure. It gives the United States a lot of leverage. I really would be opposed to any sort of deal where, you know, we have multiple summits to have the deal or, you know, anything like that that stretches the timeline out. Either they're going to denuclearize or not. If the answer is no, there's no point in really talking anymore. We need to keep the maximum pressure campaign going, because once it's done, it's done. It's going to be very hard to put Kim Jong-un back in that containment box.
Harry Kazianis is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you so much for your time today.
Always fun. Thank you.
It has been another Friday of violent clashes along the Israeli border with the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Thousands of Palestinians held marches on the Gaza border, culminating 2 months of weekly Friday protests aimed at breaking an Israeli and Egyptian blockade. This demonstration came on the last Friday of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and coincided with Jerusalem Day, an annual anti-Israel protest in Iran. As demonstrators approached the border, they were confronted by Israeli troops. Soldiers fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowds, and snipers used live ammunition to prevent a breach of the border fence. The international community has accused Israel of an excessive use of force during the protests, which left more than 115 Palestinians dead since the end of March. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel has the right to defend its borders against acts of violence by a terrorist organization, a reference to the Islamic militant group Hamas that rules Gaza.
They organize this Hamas, they pay for some civilians to come, and they pretend that it's a peaceful protest, but this is not a peaceful protest. They come in with pipe bombs, they come in with weapons, come in with explosives.
Despite the high Palestinian death toll, Hamas is declaring victory. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh said martyrdom is the price Palestinians must pay to break the blockade and confront the Israeli occupation. Once again, the Palestinians employed a primitive but effective new weapon that has caused heavy damage in Israel. They flew flaming kites across the border to burn Israeli crops and nature preserves. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian lawmakers have lifted the controversial state of emergency imposed across the country 3 months ago. We'll examine the most significant reform so far by the country's new Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, the host of CNN's food and travel-focused Parts Unknown television series, has died. AP correspondent Warren Levinson.
The network says a close friend, the chef Eric Repair, found Bourdain unresponsive. Anthony Bourdain was 61. He first gained fame with his 2000 book, Kitchen Confidential, a bestseller that led to series on the Food Network and then on CNN, for which he was in Paris shooting an episode of his series Parts Unknown, now in its 11th season. CNN says Anthony Bourdain was a unique storyteller.
And celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay tweeted that he was stunned and saddened by Bourdain's death. Ramsay wrote that Bourdain brought the world into our homes and inspired so many people to explore cultures. Dr. Mitch Prinstein is the director of clinical psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I asked him about the prevalence of suicide.
Suicide most often occurs in the context of mental illness, but it does not require a diagnosis or prior difficulties with mental illness. It's remarkably prevalent, much more so in the United States than most other places in the world, and sometimes it occurs after the experience of stress, in a moment of impulsivity and poor problem-solving skills when people just feel trapped and like they have no other solution. But what we know now is that when people are thinking about suicide, it's as if their ideas and mind and solutions have become restricted. They're not thinking about how this will hurt other people. They're not thinking about other solutions. This is the only thing that they can think of to end really debilitating pain and stress. So as much as it is something that others will call selfish, recognize that to the person who's suicidal, they are unable to think of anything but how to stop feeling so, so badly or get out of a horrible situation. And probably they're not meaning to do it, to hurt others or to ignore the needs of others.
If someone feels that one of their friends or loved ones is contemplating suicide, what is something that they should do?
Without hesitation, you've got to get somebody who might be at risk for suicide to a qualified mental health professional, a psychologist, who can really do what we know can work to reduce depression and to help people come up with more safe solutions than hurting themselves. A lot of people feel like bringing up suicide or asking people about suicide may somehow trigger new ideas in somebody, and they refrain from asking people direct questions. That's a mistake. There's no evidence that talking about suicide makes people more suicidal. In fact, it's very likely to save a life. Simply asking them, have you been thinking about hurting yourself or ending your life? It's a simple question that is scary to ask, I understand, but it's very important to ask people directly. And many people who are suicidal feel relieved that someone has brought that up and given them the opportunity to talk that seriously about how badly they're feeling.
Dr. Prinstein, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Anthony Bourdain, dead at the age of 61. One final note before I do go today. On this date back in 1968, authorities announced the capture in London of James Earl Ray, the suspected assassin of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And in 632, the Prophet Muhammad died in Medina. And you know what? That is going to do it for me today. Patrice Martin directed today's program, and Nick Ivanov, well, he engineered the broadcast. But before I do go, I would like to thank you for spending part of your day with us. If you haven't already, be sure to follow The Voice of America on social media. That's where we post pictures, videos, stories, and a whole lot more. You can find us on Twitter, The Book of Face, Facebook, and of course, Instagram. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 8th, much of the world observes United Nations World Oceans Day. The idea is to remind people how important the world's oceans are to all life on Earth, to celebrate their beauty, and to bring attention to the impact human activity has on the oceans. This year, the theme is preventing plastic pollution and encouraging solutions for a healthy ocean. The world's oceans cover nearly three-fourths of the Earth's surface and contain 97% of our planet's water. They produce over half of our oxygen, help regulate our climate, absorb carbon dioxide, and support the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Nearly half of all species on Earth depend on the oceans for survival, and for many of the rest, including for people, the oceans improve the quality of life. The oceans are also indispensable to the world's economy because they are key to transportation and recreation. And inasmuch as over 95% of the underwater realm remains unexplored, it is nearly a certainty that their depths may hold the cure to many a disease, the resolution to many a problem. And yet, as much as 40% of the world's oceans are heavily affected by human activities that result in pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats. Of particular concern is plastic debris. Some of it comes from ships that ply our rivers, lakes, and seas, and eventually makes its way into the ocean. But about 8 million metric tons of plastic waste washes off land into the ocean each year. Once there, it begins to break down until it turns into small fragments known as microplastics. Plastics are a serious threat because they degrade very slowly, entangle sea creatures, damage habitats like coral reefs, and are ingested by marine animals. Researchers have documented impacts of plastic on over 650 different marine species, including sea turtles, seals, whales, dolphins, porpoises, seabirds, and fish. On World Oceans Day, we must remember that the health and safety of our oceans is our collective responsibility, one that we cannot afford to neglect. Only through good stewardship can we safeguard the health of our oceans and ensure that the oceans continue to meet the needs of future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.